welcome to episode 30 of the Rewrap Podcast, where we talk all things photo, video, and the creative lifestyle. Today, I've got editor-in-chief of Resource Mag Online, the Jaren Schneider. Say hi, Jaren.
Hi.
And I've got special guest Dave Geffen out of Brooklyn, New York, a photographer, videographer, and fellow ResourceMagOnline.com writer.
Hello.
Dave Geffen. Hello. So hi. Hello. And I'm portrait and headshot photographer Karaminder Guman. First story this week, Apple released a bunch of new stuff, which we did talk about last week, right, Jaren?
We talked about stuff that you were expecting, and you ended up being 100% right, or whatever yes. whatever website you were citing ended up being 100% right.
This is true, yeah. So the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus was announced with 4K recording, which is pretty good, went higher megapixels. We were at like 8 megapixels for a long time, for I think 4 generations, and now it's at 12. My little Canon S110, which I use as a little video camera, is 12 megapixels. And now I'm like, why do I have this? And then I remember, oh yeah, optical image stabilization.
One of my friends, he works at Airbnb. He actually was the guy who made the app that for Airbnb, like he was developing it for the Apple release that they had during their like show off of their partners.
Mm-hmm. And I believe that was the Apple TV part of the
Was it?
Yeah, because it was an Airbnb app for the Apple TV.
Okay, good. It shows you how much I watched. Anyway, he was telling me the reason why it took Apple so long to up the megapixels is because they're more focused on the quality of megapixels than
yes.
numbers.
Yes, so, they are.
Rather than people showing off with big number of megapixels, they wanted to go like quality. So I appreciate that.
Right. And Dave, what did you think about, having... be able to shoot 4K in your little smartphone?
It's pretty impressive, to say the least. But is it going to make for better video content? That's a big question.
Bigger question is everyone's going to buy the cheaper iPhone, the one with this lower gigabyte limit, and they're going to fill that up in about 2 days?
Yeah, I mean, I can't work with 4K on my computer and everything that I have at the moment, so I don't know how a phone's going to process all of that, but I'm sure it's going to handle it in some way. I don't know. I think there's an obsession with like 4K in a phone that's just, we're missing a bigger picture.
What's the bit rate or the compression on that? Do you know, Karaminder?
Yeah, I did. I texted it to you. It was 30 megabits per second. So it's a very small bit rate for 4K
tiny.
Video. I want to say 30. Was it 50? I mean, I'm pretty sure it was
anything,
30.
Anything under 100 is tiny.
Oh, it's 50. Yeah, it's definitely 50. It's way under 100. But basically, it's just tiny. You're not going to be able to like do any grading or color correction or change the white balance without tearing that video apart. And you know, they mentioned on when they came out with the iPad Pro is that it can handle 3 4K streams. And I'm assuming that they meant 3 4K streams that were recorded from their iPhone 6S. And so that means it's handling 3 very low bitrate streams, not you know, red 4K. Which is, I don't know, how many megabits
per
second.
Or even GH4 or even Sony Alpha series. It can't do any of those.
Not that it can't do it, but I'm pretty sure it can't do 3 at the same time. Maybe 1, perhaps maybe 2. But like the processor in that iPad Pro is just very like desktop class. Like I'm sure it's almost fast or just as fast as maybe a MacBook Air from about 2-3 years ago. Like that's pretty impressive to have that much power. And the latency on that with the new Pencil thing and how they tested it between a Wacom Cintiq and the iPad Pro is that the latency, which is what they made a big deal about, of when the stylus or the pencil touches the screen and how quickly the display reacts to what you're doing, is very tiny. And I guess it's class leading. It's faster than the Cintiq. So for retouching purposes, that looks amazing.
Yeah, we talked about one of those apps. Was it last week we talked about?
Yeah, AstroPad. We talked about that, yes.
Yeah,
which already links directly to Lightroom.
Right. Connect it with something like that, and then you have a much cheaper version of the Cintiq, too.
Yeah. I think it's just a good thing overall, just to be able to, that we have a newer, more, like Apple's not sitting on their laurels. They've got a better camera out. More gooder camera out. That's always going to be good, as they are shown time and time again on like stats like on 500px and Flickr, where what is the most popular camera used that uploads images? And well, it's the Apple iPhones. It's the future. Well, it's going to be. I put my pre-order in. Do you guys? Any of you guys?
No. I don't pre-order things on principle.
I generally don't either, but I still feel that my 6 is like new, you know? I don't know. I've never been an interim type of update person. In fact, the 6 was my first journey over to Apple because I was a long-time Android user.
Oh, really? Yeah. And how did you find it? Are you going to stay? Or are you going to switch back?
For the moment, I'm staying because the reasons I moved in terms of like the improved camera and video capabilities, that stuff is great. And I don't think adding 4K into it for what I have now is a big enough reason for me to upgrade. I don't know, I could be wrong, but no pre-order this side.
I usually upgrade and then I hand my previous phone to my father and I sell his phone, which he basically every year has my hand-me-down, which makes it easier for me to get the newest phone because once I sell his phone unlocked, helps me pay down the next one. And I'm all about selling and buying gear as opposed to, I don't know, buying gear and then keeping old gear. I can't do that. I don't, too much clutter. But what about live photos? Did you guys see that?
Dave, did you actually watch the Apple thing? I was out shooting that day, so I couldn't watch
it. No, I didn't watch it. I did do a little bit of digging into kind of what had been announced and stuff like that, but I didn't watch it live. I rarely watch that stuff live. I'm not like one of these people that has to know the moment it's announced, you know, what's going on.
I used to watch them, and then this time I'm like, well, I'll just read about it. And then I just didn't even really read about it. Like I'm like grossly behind because for some reason I just didn't care that much about this. I figured, I guess in my mind, no matter what it was, I was going to buy it because it's time for me to upgrade my phone. I have my 5S still. I have a 6 Plus, but I only use it for my second screen when I'm doing video. So I don't really use it as my phone. And I was telling myself I was going to get whatever the next S version was. So it didn't really matter to me what it was because I'm probably going to buy it anyway. And the iPad Pro isn't really something I'm interested in either. From just I don't see myself using it. I might. We'll see. I don't know. But it wasn't like a huge deal to me. I'm not into Apple TV unless they actually make an actual television. This wasn't anything about a new Mac Pro. I mean, there's just nothing in here that to me was as huge of a deal as I think that I would be looking for in something. So it didn't matter to me quite as much, but I can appreciate the people that are like way into it, like Karaminder here.
Yeah.
For me, it was easier for me to, for some reason, just to not care this time.
Yeah. I mean, the big thing with Apple was the watch, which everyone kind of knew, and that's been announced. Mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious about the Pencil and how this responds in terms of the feeling that you get from the interaction on the new iPad Pro, but only could... Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
What I just said is not to disregard anything Apple announced. It's just that I, for some reason, was able to care less this time than I have in previous years.
Absolutely. No, I tell you when I'll be excited and when I'll be watching a live announcement is when I can take that Pencil and instead of using my small tablet to edit is when I can actually interact with video feeds on an iPad, whatever it is, and use that Pencil live and scrub through footage and do that. And we're obviously a ways away from that. But that's when I'm going to get excited about this kind of stuff. At the moment, it's just like, it seems like a novelty to me. But that's because I haven't really got that much practical application for it.
Dave, I think you can do that with video. Just you cannot do that with video that you probably sourced from, let's say, a I don't know, Canon 5D Mark III. Is that what you shoot with, right, for video? Or Red?
It's a mix of stuff and some of the Canon cinema cameras more recently with various projects. So it's a mix of different cameras which I tend to use. But do you know what I mean? Like instead of watching something through the screen and interacting with a tablet, when we get the combination of the technology that allows us to physically touch something to the screen and manipulate it and touch that kind of interface, which is where things seem to be sort of going, that's when I'm going to be more excited about these different interface devices.
I think that started with like the Microsoft table, which then became, I guess it became the Surface and it's kind of carried on with the iPad. I was talking about live photos, so none of you guys probably know what this is, but when you take a still photo on the 6S, any of the 6S or 6S Plus, It takes the photo, but what it also records in the slight background is that I think that 1 or 2 seconds before you actually touch that shutter button and the 1 or 2 seconds after. So using like what they call 3D touch, which used to be called force touch, which you just apply pressure to the screen with your thumb, it'll play it. It'll play the second before, the couple seconds before and through the shot that you took to the 2 seconds after. So you can kind of see that's what they're calling a live photo. It's basically just a short little video clip, which is kind of nice. I'm sure this is a other companies have tried this before. I guess HTC with their Zoe feature on an M7 a few years back, but I guess it's not as popular as when Apple does something like this. And then of course, Jaren, you know, they work with Hermes to make more custom Apple Watch Hermeses, but
it's neither Hermes, here nor there, isn't it?
Hermes. Is it Hermes?
Hermes. No, it's Hermes.
See, me and Dave say Hermes. Jaren says Hermes. We don't know who's right. I'm not going to say I'm right. I could be wrong.
It's spelled Hermes.
Yes, it is spelled Hermes.
Hermes.
And I guess I've always pronounced it Hermes.
Yeah, I think it has got an S, but I could be wrong.
It does. I thought the S was silent.
No, I don't think so. What kind of podcast is this?
at any rate, it's something that doesn't matter to the three
Absolutely.
Of us.
Absolutely.
No matter what. 0% matters.
Yeah, moving on. So it was announced this week that it was the Washington Post had taken a photograph of like a TSA guy in the back working security. And in that photograph was, I guess, their master keys, the TSA master keys.
You know, to open some the locks on your luggage?
Yeah, some guy took that picture of the of those TSA master locks, 3D printed them, and now it's out there on the wild of the internet that you can download these like image files or model files or 3D printer files and make your own TSA master locks at home. Yeah. And it will open up your TSA master locks on your luggage and stuff like that. So all this from a single photograph.
Was it Washington Post? Or
Washington Post.
They took the photo down as soon as they heard that some guy made a CAD out of it. But at that point, it was way too late.
Yep. The title of the story was The Secret Life of Baggage. Where does your luggage go at the airport?
Yeah. So now anyone can download this and print it themselves at home. And
but
they
do
have
you guys,
a master key.
But do you guys feel, I don't know, any difference? I'll be honest. I don't feel any difference. Like, I don't care. Because the thing is, our luggage has to be able to be unlocked by them anyway. And so as long as my luggage and baggage is in my possession, if I'm submitting my baggage to the airport, I'm automatically assuming that it's basically unlocked anyway, even with my TSA.
I don't lock my stuff when I check it. It's pointless.
Yeah. It's pointless. But I don't expect my TSA lock on my camera gear. I don't have any when I'm just not going through an airport. I only use TSA lock gear when I'm going through an airport. So to me, it doesn't really matter.
I get what you're saying.
You guys?
The point of this story to me is so much bigger than whether or not we should lock or unlock our luggage as it goes through TSA or security, though. The point of this is with the cameras that we have taking the amount of kind of data through the ever-increasing megapixel count that they're coming with, and then what people are doing with those fairly sort of innocuous and innocent photographs through 3D printing is kind of like mind-blowing, no? I think this is...
Yeah, it is.
I think that is the bigger takeaway, is like when you take a picture, you got to really understand the greater ramifications of the image.
Exactly. Like a year or 2 years ago, this was not even an issue. A year or 2 years ago, what I remember became an issue was when they would photograph politicians running from one meeting to another, and they would have files with them that you could punch in and scale up the image to the point where you could read what some of these documents actually said. That was...
Yeah, CSI Miami stuff where like zoom
exactly.
in.
Exactly.
Zoom in.
Exactly, enhance.
Enhance.
But now what they're doing is they're saying, well, not only can we see it, but we can actually throw that into, you know, AutoCAD or make a 3D model of something that a two-dimensional photograph has seen and use that. That to me is pretty mind-blowing. That's nuts.
Like, locks only keep honest people out anyway, so I don't really care about this. I agree with Dave that it just makes you think, like, what else is possible with the images that we're taking and what are the ramifications of those images? I guess people have been taking pictures of keys for a long time. I don't think anyone, it occurred to them, except for the dude who did it, to think, I wonder if I could make a CAD of that and then print it.
Well, actually, there's a lot. There's even an app called Keymi on iOS where you just take a picture of your key and you can get a replica sent to your home. Or the idea is that you take a picture of your key before And if you're locked out, that you this service then already can get a reproduced key to you quickly.
That's cheaper.
No, that's well, I guess it is. Well, it's out there, Kimi. Just you can do that, but it's just the grooves on the teeth and how they relate. They're numbered, and that's how key reproducers do it. Yeah. Key replicators, not key.
I mean, that's frightening to me. That thanks for blowing my mind again, because now I'm like,
ugh. Sorry.
Keys are so unsafe.
Yeah, they are.
Let's move to something else.
Okay, how about I love this quote. It was from a Resource Magazine article about the A7R2 review. And it was written by a lovely gentleman. His name was Jaron Schneider. And the quote goes, "I feel confident in saying the A7S Mark II will not have high frame rate at full HD." Then you know what Sony did? They announced the A7S Mark II. And
with high frame rate and full HD?
Yeah, how much? How much, okay, is it? 120?
First, let me make a correction on there right there. That statement wasn't in my A7R2 review. It was in my, the A7R2 can't shoot 10-bit or HFR. That was the article I mentioned that in. And the reason I thought this, and I probably should have done a little bit more thinking on it, but so the reason the A7 R2 can't do high frame rate is a mix between the Exmor sensor and the Bions X processor. And from when I was talking to Mark Weir about it, the guy who told me that the reasons why it can't do it, he said it was a combination of those two things. So in my mind, I'm like, well, I'm pretty sure the Sony A7 S2 is going to have the Bions X processor in it. So that processor was already having a hard enough time doing stuff like taking pictures in succession on the A7 R2. Why would it be able to allow high frame rate in the A7 S2? It turns out that it does have that enough power, and because Sony uses a different type of sensor in the S cameras than it does in the R cameras, it is able to do it. So looking at it, it is probably actually possible for them to have done it in the original A7S, but they didn't. Now they did it in the next one. Because I was looking at the type of sensor that it was using. It's not a BSI. It's just a regular Exmor CMOS. And so it, the way it transmits data is different than the way that it transmits data on the A7R.
So it feels like, Jaron, correct me if I'm wrong, they kept with the same sensor that was in the previous A7S, but they added a new processor and able to get more out of the sensor because they got a better processor.
No, the processor is the same. I was confused. It's the Bions X. It's the same sensor that all of the Sony Alpha cameras have been using forever.
Okay.
They have allowed the same sensor. They've updated the sensor, but it's the same style sensor to allow it to do what I just described. So I think, personally, that they just didn't put it in to the original A7S. I think it could have done it. Even though this new A7S 2 sensor is newer and has better ISO performance and better data transfer rate, mm-hmm. I still think they just chose not to put it in the A7S 1. That's what I believe. I have no way to prove that. But now it's in the A7S 2, and it's pretty clear that it wasn't being hobbled by that processor alone. It was just the sensor. That's all I got. It's confusing. You're looking at me with a look of confusion.
It's on you, Dave.
That is a lot of information. Man, I want to get my hands on these this new Sony camera, though, because there's a lot of good stuff that I'm hearing about it from people that I've picked up on in the last few days. And I really haven't played with these small Sony cameras that much. I played with the original, which is the one with the really high ISO performance. Yeah, I played with that just before it came out, and we were playing poker, flipped off the lights, and the thing could see us all in the dark. It was insane. That was pretty interesting, but I haven't, you know, that was a while ago. I haven't played with much of this Sony lineup since then.
The camera feels a lot different now. They changed the body. They made it bigger, and I think they made it bigger for two reasons: heat sinking reasons, which it still has trouble with, and the fact that they added 5-axis image stabilization on the inside, so on the sensor itself, so it needs more room to move around in there. But the camera itself still, like, it feels thinner than the GH4, which to me is a kind of a beefy camera, actually, when you look at it. It's not a tiny camera. I like them a lot. I'm becoming a Sony fanboy, actually. I'm liking the stuff they're doing. So, I mean, I don't know if that means anything to you, Dave.
Sony is about the only brand at the moment that I'm kind of excited about, not just because of these smaller mirrorless cameras, but the new FS5, whatever it was as well.
That's in between the FS7 and the FS700, the FS5.
Yeah, the thing is they're coming out with stuff that seems to be giving people a lot of functionality at price points that are reasonable. You know what I mean? Like, I can't afford 20 grand almost on a Canon C300 Mark II, which is already technically behind the curve. So Sony are definitely doing stuff right. I just want to get more hands-on with some of the stuff because I haven't really seen and played around too much with them, and I don't know what the look of these cameras is like. But I know people that have shot stuff with them, and it's really impressive-looking stuff. Like, there's no reason why I would discount any of the stuff that Sony's coming out with, whether it's the smaller mirrorless stuff or the slightly bigger sort of camcorders or cinema type cameras. Like, they really seem to be doing a lot for people. And it's been a while since Sony has been like that.
I would say it's been almost never since they've been like that. If you look back just a little while ago, I was complaining about this just last year. If you wanted to shoot 4K with the FS700, it would cost you about $20,000 to do it because you had to buy a bunch of these little add-on parts. Yeah. And it was just an absurd thing. And now, a year later, they have multiple 4K internal options, all of which are under $5,000.
Yeah, I mean, they're pushing. It's really awesome. And of course, that pushes up the usability because you don't have to. First of all, it's just reasonable in terms of the cost. And the second is you don't have to bolt on an external 4K recorder.
Yeah, that's the worst.
So, I don't know. Everyone wants stuff smaller and lighter, basically. It doesn't even matter if you're strapping this thing to a drone or not. I want to be able to move about quickly and not have stuff that can produce either high frame rates or something with, you know, decent dynamic range for either extortionate sort of high cost to me in terms of the work I'm doing or in terms of the weight, because that, you know, the weight and the size, that really impacts the ability to move around
quickly. Sounds like you're going to like the A7S II then, because it has all of
like that. I say, the A7S II and the FS5, some of this stuff is like popping up in my Facebook feed, and I'm like, it's the only stuff that I'm sort of pausing on in terms of new camera news.
So you said that's the only company you can think of that excites you. There's one more for me that does, and that's DJI. Did you see what they announced last week, Dave?
No, I can't think off the top of my head. What was it?
They announced two mirrorless Micro Four Thirds cameras with interchangeable lenses. Oh,
that's right. Yeah, I did see that, but I didn't really delve into that.
I think it's cool, and I think it's also DJI basically getting ahead of the companies that are building cameras specific for drones and being like, you don't need to go to anybody else. DJI will hold your hand and get you through everything. And I think that's what they want to be. Yeah. They want to be a one-stop for everything drone. Hey, look, Cameron, we're talking about drones again.
I know. went from Sony to drones.
I just wanted to bring it up. The sensor. I don't know who makes DJI sensor. I still don't know who makes Blackmagic sensors. They don't release that information, but from what I saw of the footage coming out of the new Inspire cameras, very impressive stuff. So I like the companies that are pushing the envelope and giving us things that we either weren't expecting or stuff that's beyond what we were expecting, which is what Sony and DJI are repeatedly doing. So yeah. I'm down. These guys are awesome. I'm done talking about drones.
Yeah.
But Dave, what do you shoot with now for most of your video stuff that you do? Or is it like on a, I don't know, per project basis?
Per project, I guess. So, you know, my camera, my go-to is still my 5D Mark III. A lot of my clients don't need anything more than just a full HD output. The one thing that Canon do consistently well, and this is why I'm excited about the C300 Mark II, if I can get my hands on it, which I think I should be able to, right? And that's, you know, when I say get my hands on it, I mean probably use it without having to actually buy the thing, because that's the huge negative for me with that camera. It's just way too expensive. But I am excited to use it because I still really like the Canon look. And the C300 gives me certain things that, okay, other manufacturers are coming out with, like built-in NDs and stuff like that. And the fact that it's now 4K, it's interesting. You know, if you put a bunch of cameras in front of me and give me the option to use any of them for free, I would probably say I'd probably quickly gravitate towards the C300. It's a good camera. It's easy to use. It's light. And that's why I'm interested to try the Mark II. I couldn't buy it though. That's the thing. I couldn't think about buying it. But yeah, I mean, and I've shot some stuff recently with Red, Epic, Dragons, all the way through back down to DSLRs. It really depends on the project, what we're doing.
Okay. By the way, the C300, is that a Super 35 sensor size sensor compared to, let's say, you're used to shooting full frame on your 5D Mark III?
Yeah, I believe it's Super 35.
Yeah, it is. I can confirm that's what it is. Yeah. So the only ones who are making cinema cameras. The only ones who are making full frame 4K cameras right now are Sony.
That's true, yeah.
There's not a single full frame 4K video camera out there other than the A7 R2 and the A7 S2.
Did it surprise you, Jaren, of when they did announce the A7S Mark II? It was at IBC, and I guess we never heard any rumblings or any previews about it like we did about the A7R Mark II.
Yeah,
just kind of came out of nowhere.
It did. I was a little surprised. They didn't tell anyone about it, as far as I understood.
No, they didn't invite you, Jaren, to New York, and
but it was at IBC. That's in Amsterdam.
Oh, did you go to Portland? I forget where you went for the A7R.
Yeah, the A7R. I mean, they announced the A7R Mark II way before that, and then they had us come, like, actually use them. So it wasn't like I knew about... I mean, I knew about the A7R II about 6 hours before they announced it. So they didn't give me a huge amount of info before that. But the A7S II was like, oh, crap, I woke up, it's 4 a.m, and I need to write this now. So they do that on occasion. The European releases tend to be like that a lot. And IBC is really, really hectic for these guys. I mean, I just got the press release from Rode this morning about all the stuff they announced last week. So, like,
this morning.
They're a little behind. That's not unusual. The only people who were, like, on top of it were Blackmagic, and it was a small update as far as I'm concerned with Blackmagic.
What did they release, just to refresh?
It was, like, a new mount for their Ursa Mini. That was it. Just a new lens mount.
Oh, what was it?
One that I'm not familiar
B4. With. B4. That's what it was. B4.
Yeah, I don't know anything about
it. I don't even know what that is. But
yeah,
it's a B4 mount.
Never use it. That's like even more obscure than PL, I think, for a lot of people.
PL's not that obscure.
It's obscure for still photographers.
Oh, yeah. It's positive lock. It's like, I guess it's a cinema. It's the cinema mount.
Yeah, cinema only.
Standard.
Yeah.
Okay, guys. Dave.
Yo.
Can you tell me the difference between freelance and unemployed?
The difference between freelance and unemployed? Well, at times, as a freelancer, it feels like I'm unemployed. Or it has done.
This is true, because I'm with you. I'm in that same boat.
The thing with freelancing is it's like a roller coaster. And it's funny because for 3 years, I've effectively been a freelancer. A little less than 3 years. I set my company up just under 3 years ago. But I came from having a very healthy career as a full-time salaried employee.
You were a salary man.
Oh, yeah. And when you step off that gravy train, or whatever you want to call it, and launch yourself into the world of freelancing, it's like, am I actually working? And how am I going to earn money? And who are my clients? And that plagued me for a while, because I just hadn't ever done this before. I'd had side businesses, but those are very, very different. When you launch yourself into a freelance career, particularly when you don't know anyone, which is exactly what my situation was when I moved from London to New York, it's really scary. And at times I was like, am I actually employed? What am I doing? What happens is that you transition away from that into a, how am I going to do everything with all of the demands of the various clients that I have going on? And then you can reach like the peak of the hill, roller coaster, and go over the other side. And it's like, now I've got time on my hands again. What am I going to do next? There is obviously a very distinct difference, like being a freelancer and being unemployed. I think we can all attest to the roller coaster ride, but Yeah, it's just, it's a different way of working, basically. I don't know. What do you guys
Creative
think?
Live blog, well, the Creative Live blog put this article up, and they gave a good number of tips as well. So I wanted to see, you know, you guys add some tips to this as well. But like, I love your assessment, Dave, of what exactly it is. I mean, I feel that way too. It's a roller coaster. There's highs and there's lows, and there's good paydays, and there's like, what, this is it, or this is all I'm going to get for this, and I kind of need to take this job to make ends meet. But at least to kind of give a more, I don't know, I guess the idea is that to give a more professional impression, the tips that they provide are, number one, you got to own your web presence. So, you know, that means just focusing on your website, making sure you're Google and SEO friendly, and that you're, everything, your Twitter, your Facebook, your LinkedIn, everything is consistent and gives a very professional image, right? And again, this is also important. They want you, they also give the tip of treating being freelance like a business, right? So this means proper like the business side of stuff, like paperwork and billing and invoicing, and making sure that your logo, if you have one, you should get one if you don't have one, you know, whether you get one from the internet, whether you design it yourself, putting that everywhere consistently, keeping a calendar. I know, Dave, you're a Google calendar guy. Yep. And Jaron, you're a Google calendar guy as well. I guess I'm.
Yep.
I'm an Apple calendar guy.
I don't like Apple calendar. It doesn't work very well when you try and use it with people who aren't using Apple calendar.
Oh, well, sorry. Well, it worked great for me. And at least you guys both checked in with me to see what time we're recording today, which is good. And then also they recommend, lastly, looking the part. I guess, you know, dress for the position you want to be in. The idea is to not look as scruffy. And Jaron, I don't know what that hand gesture was, but I'm sure you can tell us
me,
all.
It's me adjusting my Dave Geffen hat.
Oh, okay. I thought you're adjusting your top hat. That's good enough, yes. But Jaron, any tips? Any more tips to, you know, help you being freelance and looking more professional, or just, you know, not so looking as so scrubby and unemployed?
I don't know. I live in as a San Francisco person, being scrubby and unemployed is kind of a fashion look. Like,
but that's the look, man.
Yeah, that's how I roll, man. That's what I do. I think for me, it's difficult for people to maintain the drive, the self drive, to continue doing stuff when you could very easily not do something. I think I've said this before, but the web presence one, I actually do want to go and make sure to look on a lot. We have people write for Resource, and we pay everybody. But at certain times, like, people want to write for us, and I can't afford to have them on because my budget's full. I think if people look at that and still think, I'm going to write for you anyway, that's a good attitude to have. Not because I want your free labor, which I absolutely do, but because when you write for websites and you use those to promote your own website, for example, whenever I write anything, or whenever another one of our writers, Mike Wilkinson, writes anything, we link to our own websites. We boost our own SEO through those articles that we write. So it's better than blogging on your own website, which you're probably going to do anyway, and if you're not, you should be. So creating that web presence and that content regularly and having stuff linking back to your site all the time is really good, especially if you need to stay up on your SEO and continue to get work coming in, which you do, and I do. So
this is true. All right, moving on. When photographers become endorsements, this is from Photo Shelter. I love their content, by the way. Photo Shelter, great content.
They're kicking it right now. I like it.
They are. But written by Alan Murabayashi. I'm going to go out on a limb, assume he's Japanese. Lovely guy. I assume he is as well. So the article goes on and says, you know, with a lot of people spending their time on, say, Instagram, right? Just general people. And what's happened is, I guess, photographers, people who post to Instagram consistently, who have an audience, these major brands like Toyota, Mercedes-Benz.
American Express.
American Express, Audi, Land Rover, Time. They reach out to these guys with their followings, and then they become paid endorsers of said product. Now, this is kind of a new thing for photographers. Usually, you know, photojournalists, all that well is dried up, right? And so now, not only are we just, like, you know, talking about camera gear and workshops or other gear, now there's this other, I guess, realm that can I guess it's not a revenue stream, more like a business tactic, I suppose. But that's kind of, you know, they hire you to become a bit of a brand ambassador. And whether it is that you take over their feed for a little while or you work together on a project with a unified hashtag.
So what I'm showing or attempting to show right now, this is my Instagram thing, and there's a video playing. This is a guy I follow. His name is Paul Nicklin. He is a National Geographic photographer. And it looks like American Express took him out and made a commercial with him, like the ones you'll see on TV, like of the people, like, you know, swiping their card and doing their thing. It looks just like their TV commercials, which I think is what they were going for. Mm-hmm. But it's featuring Paul Nicklin and him doing his thing, and they posted it only on Paul's Instagram. So it's, I don't know how much this cost, but I'm sure Paul got a lot of money for it. What's funny about it is they say American Express card member since whenever for some people. Like, it's supposed to be a good thing. Like, I've been a member since 2004. His has been a member since 2015. So he clearly was not using American Express until they're like, hey, we'd like you to rep our brand. It's a very well-produced commercial. I just think it's interesting, and I don't know how sustainable this actually is. Oh, I didn't mean to play it. I don't know how sustainable this is. I think Instagram is going to catch on to this sort of thing because Instagram's not getting any of that, and it's their platform.
And yeah, they're supposed to be doing the ads, right? Like, as you scroll
through.
Yeah,
you're supposed to be buying Instagram ads, but these people are going straight to the content creators, which is smarter.
But yeah, because it's the only app right now that doesn't filter your feed, right? Like, Facebook filters your feed.
Yeah, Facebook filter. I mean,
who else?
But well, Snapchat forget, doesn't filter.
Guys, don't forget. Yeah, Dave. Sorry to jump in. Don't forget, obviously, Facebook owns Instagram. Everyone knows that.
Right.
And yeah. Facebook makes a lot of money through advertising. So what Instagram has become, which has even exceeded my expectations, I wrote an article about the importance of Instagram. I can't remember when it was, a year and a half ago, something like that. Yeah. And I was quite a late adopter to Instagram. But if you get the situation where big brands, really impressive, top tier blue chip brands, are paying and commissioning jobs through Instagram, that those photographers, because they are photographers or filmmakers or whatever you want to call them, are then putting that stuff out into their feed, what you're creating is quite a virtuous circle of interest, right? And brands are going to continue to want to handpick those photographers, those creatives that are able to tap into their large social audiences. The photographers are going to want to connect with those top tier brands because obviously it leads to commercial work. I don't think there's anything negative or I don't see a downside for this.
There definitely isn't. The downside would be from Instagram's perspective. They're not making any money on this. Facebook is going to want a piece of every pie.
Yeah.
And I guarantee you they know this is happening and are trying to figure out ways to where they make money on this as well. So where they can get money out of American Express.
I guess the conflict of interest that they cite here is that there are photojournalists on Instagram, right? Mm-hmm. And it's those Toyota hired photojournalists, I think four or five of them, for an assignment. And so then how do you strive that? How do you ride that line of, like, I guess photojournalism, what's the word? Like authenticity while still hawking for a brand?
Well, that goes back to what is a photojournalist and what is the role of a quote-unquote photojournalist on a job, right? Because if you look at Ben Lowry is a good one. He's quite big on Instagram. He's a very well-known photojournalist.
He's the one that was hired by Toyota, by the way.
Yeah, that's right. He was mentioned in the article, wasn't he? But, you know, those people, or Steve McCurry, you know, people that go off and bring us news and bring us insights from across the globe, which is really, you know, what photojournalists still do, and there's many very good ones still active out there. If those people are then commissioned to provide that same vision and way of telling something through visual media to a commercial job, I don't see there being a conflict of interest necessarily. Am I crazy for thinking that? Because they're not necessarily reporting on something. They're trying to sell this product or doing whatever they do, but they're bringing their vision to that. Isn't that what we're meant to be doing as filmmakers, photographers, creatives, is being able to find a way to supplement our lives as, you know, storytellers.
Yeah, and we have all this, and we have direct publishing, right? We don't have a middleman that we have to represent or worry about. It's just our own brands that we put out, and we define what that is. So I guess not much of a, at least in my eyes, we follow the person and their values, and it's just that whatever they choose. I don't think that, I wouldn't say that someone's, well, I guess someone could sell out, or in the case of other people, the other opinion is you can buy in.
I don't think that yet any of these people who did these things for these companies are getting the feeling that they're selling out.
No,
like,
I don't think so.
I think they'd have to do it repeatedly and gratuitously for me to feel
Kim Kardashian.
Which can happen. I don't think it's not impossible. I think it can totally happen, but right now they're okay. If Paul makes like six more for six different companies, then I'd be like, all right, Paul, you're going a little overboard here. Nat Geo is a for-profit company now. You should be able to make a little bit more money.
Yeah. And I think this article focuses on Instagram, but I mean, this is not uncommon with Twitter, right? You have, if your last name starts with K and ends in Kardashian, then, you know, that's a very popular way they pay per tweet. There's also YouTubers, right? Like, I'm thinking of like
PewDiePie,
Superwoman, who's dead by Lily. PewDiePie. Is that right? PewDiePie is up.
No, it's PewDiePie.
PewDiePie.
Yeah, PewDiePie. That's weird. Never heard anyone say that.
I thought it was PewDiePie.
No, it's good though. You should make a competing YouTube channel called PewDiePie and probably get sued.
No interest. You know what? Those people playing video games get a ridiculous amount of traffic.
Yeah, they do. Ridiculous. Yeah, they're called Watch Me Plays. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That and Mall Halls. I don't know if you guys know what Mall Halls are, Dave.
No, I know who PewDiePie is though.
Okay. So a mall hall is when you go to the mall, you go shopping, you come back and you record what you bought at the mall. That's a haul from the mall.
The other one that's popular in Korea is like people watching each other eat gigantic food.
I forget what those are called.
BJs, that's what they're called.
Are they?
Yeah.
I guess it's a Korean word, right?
It's something else. Their real actual word is something else, but they're also called BJs.
Yeah. Whatever it is, it comes down to the same thing, which is companies want to pay to directly connect to eyeballs based on the followers. Right now, if you're Kim Kardashian or whoever, let's just use her as an example, you've got that captive audience. She's not a professional photographer, but she's still going to be paid to put stuff out. The bigger question to me is like, what does that mean for us? In really simple terms, it means that you should have a clear vision of what you want to shoot, whatever that may be, right? Whether it's food or fashion or whatever, and follow that, and also make sure that you spend time cultivating your own brand and your marketing, all the stuff that we're told consistently. The reason it's more important than ever is because there's that direct access to the content creator. There is no middleman. You don't need to go to an agent and pay fees. That makes the onus much more important on us to make sure that we are cultivating something, putting something out there. Do you know what I mean? Because that's the way the world is going. Brands are going to go straight to the people that have got the audiences, are creating this stuff and putting it out there. And we can take something from all of that, whether it's the Kim Kardashians or whether it's, you know, the Nat Geo photographers or Ben Lowy or whoever.
Yeah. And you know, I feel like there's more... You know, before it was just like, I guess, TV shows, radio. Now it's, there's Vine, Twitter, Instagram, and depending on what your message is, YouTube even, trying to get to that demographic. But there's no, say, one leader or five leaders. There's just so many different kinds. And that I kind of like that because I guess there's just a bigger, more slices of the pie to go around, I suppose.
Yeah.
I like
that. You know what's really interesting to me? I've been thinking about this stuff a lot because you see people who rise up very quickly, particularly in Instagram, which has become my social media platform of choice. I really want to know what the kind of deals are that these companies are commissioning some of these well-known Instagrammers for. Do you know what I mean? Like, are these things commercially viable? Because the largest tranche of what I see is people with a relatively decent following not doing the top-tier commercial end clients. They're doing small things.
Do you want me to try and find out? I know someone who was just approached by a very large top tier company and it fell through. The company pulled all of their North America advertising for this particular product. But I know someone who was approached by, I would say, one of the biggest tech companies
tech product. To me, that
just out of curiosity, you want to know what the value of that would be.
Yeah, I mean, does it compare to what big commercial photography jobs used to be, or what they are now, or is it more of a, because some of these guys are doing stuff for trade, right? How often do we talk about, going back to, are we freelance or unemployed? How often do we talk about knowing our value and not doing stuff for free? A lot of these people are doing stuff for trade, right? They're not doing it to get cash and to put food on the table. That's the majority of what I see going on with Instagram at the moment. And of course, there are the people that are shooting for the higher end clientele. And I would love to know what those sorts of jobs pay. But are people doing this stuff for trade? Are they doing it for thousands of dollars? Is it for hundreds of dollars? Is it... Do you know what I mean?
That's a good question. I know one Instagrammer who, I guess, was a vacation resort. It might have been Disney, I suppose, where he got to stay there and take photos and put it up on his Instagram feed. But I'm not sure if it was trade. I guess we never asked him because, you know, I suppose unless you're personal friends, you could ask. But on a, say, public forum, I'd love to know this information. Love to be able to share it publicly. I'll leave that with Jaren to see if he can get the contact to agree to share this stuff, either anonymously or...
I mean, he strikes me as someone who wouldn't want to say, but I asked. We'll see. I just asked.
You messaged him, didn't you?
Like, right now, live on this podcast. He is responding, but I probably won't get anything out of it.
Okay, we'll see.
That's cool.
We'll move on. We'll move on. All right, guys. YOLO, You Only Live Once, written by Eric Kim on his street photography blog. And Dave, he's kind of a spirit animal to you because you both use film Leicas as your own personal photography choice, and you both shoot street.
Yeah, this is actually the first time in a long time I've been back on Eric's blog, and I met him a couple of years ago here in New York when we both end up randomly attending a Bruce Gilden talk. And he was a nice guy. I know some people don't really like him or don't really like what he stands for, but he was a nice dude and he's done a lot for the kind of street photography community in terms of directing people towards good street photographers and books and all sorts of resources, right? I read this and I was like, this is really weird. It doesn't feel like a typical Eric Kim blog post because it felt like the ramblings of someone who hadn't slept and was maybe drunk. And while I think he has really good intentions with the post, and I do agree with a lot of it, it's kind of rambly and all over the place.
Do you want to give a quick summary of what he posted?
Absolutely. Quick summary.
I think the message is still good though, but I do agree with
you.
Yeah.
Oh no, yeah, no. The message is on point. The message is, don't worry about those things that ultimately don't matter, which is material possessions and whether or not you're going to be able to upgrade to the new BMW or even the iPhone or whatever it may be, because that stuff doesn't really matter, and live each moment as if it could be your last, because you know you never know how long you've got. So the message is totally on point and definitely something I feel I live by. It was just kind of written in a sort of rather roundabout way, and it was a bit rambly, and I don't know, maybe something had gone on with Eric that day or that night or that week and it sort of all spurted out in this post, but in terms of the point, I absolutely agree. We I think take it so for granted that we're just going to wake up the next day and everything will be as normal, and you just never know the hand that life will deal you, and as you get older you learn that stuff more and more readily by seeing what goes on with friends and family and stuff like that. So I'm totally with him on the main point.
Yeah.
I mean, Jaren? Life is like you blink and it's over. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of his paragraphs, he's talking about you want to live a life without regrets. And people will often say that they don't have regrets. Their life, they don't live with regrets. They just deal with it as it is. But that's not true. You can say out loud that you live without regrets as much as you want, but that doesn't make it true. Mm. If something happens and you wish it ended differently, that's called a regret. So for me, this was my life before I became a freelancer. I was waking up every day and I was just like, I don't know what, if I do this for the next 25 years, what would be the point of me living on this earth? Like, the wealth that I accrue won't mean anything. I need to, for me, it needed to be more than just having, you know, money and the standard American, quote unquote, American dream life. I wanted more than that for myself. So I do appreciate the idea of not being a slave to whatever it is that you're working on. And the thing is, I think at some point, if I become a slave to my own work where I'm not enjoying it anymore, I'll have to find something else mm-hmm. to do. And I probably will. I don't mind shifting focus for what I do quickly and often. Because if I'm not happy, I'll find something else.
Yeah. Eric's just kind of giving... my takeaway was that he's just kind of communicate the whole, you know, time... You can't... The worst trade in life, he says, you can make is to trade time for money. So that means that, like, if you lose $100, you can always earn another $100. But if you lose a year of your life to something, you can't get that year of your life back.
Yeah, gone.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, we know all the expressions like, if you buy something expensive, you can't be buried with it. You can't take it with you.
Yeah.
To wherever you go afterwards.
And that I think is probably the most important takeaway that I took from it. And it's not necessarily like a year of our lives, but if we think about the day-to-day of what we all do, which is, do we want to take a given job and maybe invest 2 to 3 days in that job for the money versus actually, do we need the money? Because this is going back to the conversation that we've had about freelancing and are we employed mm-hmm. or unemployed? I've actually come to be much happier with not working. Right. And this was one of the big hurdles for me when I went into the freelance lifestyle. I've become much happier with not working because for a day or 2 days I haven't taken that job that I know will make me some pretty good money, but will be something I really don't want to do and will kind of crush a little bit of me internally. I will invest that time maybe by not earning anything, but by doing something, even if it's shooting on the street for the day, that will spark something within me and keep me going. And I've come only to the relatively recent realization that that is much more important. And that actually gives me the ability to sleep a little easier at night, you know?
Yeah.
I think a good way to wrap this is I was watching I was on Reddit this morning and I saw a comic that was posted. It was a Calvin and Hobbes. And it was the question, what you doing? I'm killing time while I wait for life to shower me with meaning and happiness.
Yeah. Yeah.
Essentially.
It's a little too real, actually.
Eric also recommends a great book, On the Shortness of Life by Seneca, S-E-N-E-C-A. So if you want to know more. But I guess I always see this as a spiritual point where, you know, Dave, like, as I'm going to use you as an example because it's similar to me where you have just that one camera, one lens, right? You just buy your black and white film, right? I'm not going to...
Yeah, for the most part, most part, black and white.
And you go out and you shoot, and this is for you, and you do that. And that, you know, is your happiness. And it's not like you are upgrading every time. No, how old is your camera you're using? 70s, 80s, 60s?
No, it's a little bit more modern. I think the camera's from 94, I think. I think the lens is from 72 or 73. But the point is I do that stuff and I feel so lucky to be able to do that stuff. Whereas before, I was kind of stuck in meetings or an office. And don't get me wrong, I appreciate the fact that I had a good job and I was working for a good company and I was paid well. But at some point, Jaron, as you point out, you have to ask yourself, what am I doing this for? And Steve Jobs, I don't know if you guys ever read his autobiography, he had a really good way of putting it. He said, if I looked in the mirror, he would look in the mirror every day and he would ask himself, like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And is this right? Or something like that. He had a really succinct way of looking at it. And he said, if he had to ask himself why he was doing something for more than just a few days or something, you know, consecutively, then he stopped doing it. And I think that's the best way to be. But it's also one of the hardest things to do, particularly as we get older and we get more responsibilities, right? Jaron, you're about to get married. I'm married. Don't have kids. But when kids come along, that stuff becomes much more difficult for us to say, no, I'm going to make this change. And I think that's why so many people out there want to look at becoming professional photographers. They want to kind of leave behind those jobs that they just feel aren't giving them that thing and go and do it. Even if professional photography doesn't necessarily guarantee that it will give them that thing, it's something closer to that internal satisfaction that people are missing, you know?
Yeah. And with that, I'm going to read a quote from Eric on this post to wrap up this topic. It's going to be censored. So it goes, quote, "So F money, F trying to please others, F kissing A, and never think that you have another day to live because nobody is certain. Live this day as if it were your last." And then to that, I would also end quote with Tracy Morgan, "Live every week like a shark week." All right. Kind of the last two stories kind of go together. Alex, what's his name? I forget his last name. Alex from Photo G. He wrote this article called iPhone versus Hasselblad. Are you still thinking about buying a new camera? And I'll be honest, guys, when I saw both images, I totally got this wrong. I totally got it wrong. And I shoot medium format and I use my iPhone a lot.
I got it wrong. If it makes you feel better.
You got it wrong, Jared?
I got it wrong.
I didn't try and get it right or wrong. I just read the article. Oh. Should I have tried?
Yeah, I thought it was been an interesting exercise, but at least I was impressed by the quality of the shot that you know, even after processing, you still took it with an iPhone and used an app.
Okay, I would guess
I guess
the first one is the one that would be on the Hasselblad. Am I wrong?
You are wrong. Yeah. which kind of makes me think, or makes me want to believe that I think the second shot is. I definitely like the first shot more. Mm-hmm. If you look at this article, the second shot I just don't think is done as well. But as you scroll down, you can see he used the app called 645 Pro, which allows you to kind of control all the white balance, all the shutter settings and everything on your iPhone when you take a shot. And then, of course, he post-processed it, which he's amazing at. But this example leads into this next story where it goes, gear does matter, but not how you thought it does, by DIYphotography.com. And Jared, did you get a second to read this?
I did not. I was hoping you were going to summarize it for me.
Okay, I'll summarize. Dave, you want me to summarize too?
Yeah, I had a quick scan, but summarize it for everyone.
Okay, so these essentially, you know, citing this example, you know, the whole iPhone versus Hasselblad, like we can say this, right? Often the people who are preaching, like, you don't need gear, you don't need gear, are people who have gear, right? Mm-hmm. I'm guilty. Mm-hmm. Right, I shoot with a medium format, like a rangefinder, and I still hawk that, you know, using your iPhone to make a movie is a good idea, right? And then this past weekend, like, I had the chance to shoot on a Red 1 MX, like super old 2007 digital camera, and I shot on it. It was difficult, but I did it. But I didn't shoot it with my iPhone 6S. I am calling myself out as hypocrite.
Right? You hypocrite.
Thank you, Dave. You want to get in there too? Might as well.
Yeah, I'm all right. I'll abstain. I'll let you off, mate. I'll let you off.
Thanks, mate. So the author goes through a number of different points of of the challenge of shooting with cheaper gear versus more expensive gear. The strategy involved, you have to be more strategic with shooting with cheaper gear than you do with more professional gear. And the limitations are a lot less on more expensive gear than they are on cheaper gear. And also how efficient you can be. And your reputation. But the conclusion he gets to essentially is that if you were to actually use cheaper gear to like make that outcome, like Alex did on photog.com with the iPhone versus Hasselblad, he knows how to shoot with a Hasselblad. So he knew and took all those techniques and skill that he does have and made the iPhone shot look as good as it can. And he has that ability to do that. But the gist is that you probably would not have been able to do that if he never got more expensive gear to shoot that way. And so when these photographers go on a job, they're not taking their iPhones to shoot that little whiskey ad. They're actually taking their medium format and their $12,000 brown color parabolic umbrellas with them.
It's right. That's, I mean, it's true.
Yeah, that is true. I think the first thing about the iPhone versus Hasselblad is, look at what you can get out of an iPhone, but also you've got to know your lighting, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and some post-production stuff, obviously. The second part about gear does matter, but not how you thought it does. there is this circle, which is when you sort of get into this, we think that we're lacking in the technical side, and it is the technical side that will give us a better output of work. And actually, in my humble opinion, that's not really the case at all, because someone who's very talented can produce something with an iPhone that maybe I couldn't do with, I don't know, Red Epic, for example. At the end of the day, what you come to realize when you become professional and you become surrounded by tools and access to tools is the tool matters much less than you do. That's my personal view. The difference, I think, is that clients who aren't super educated can also tell the difference now between people that run around with DSLRs versus someone that turns up to the shoot with a Red, you know.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, share more about that. Share more, like, how is it that they're able to tell, and why is it mattering to them?
I think because they realize that when someone turns up with a $30,000 or $40,000 cinema camera, whether or not they know what they're doing, that brings something to a shoot. And I remember when I read something by Zacharias, he ended up going and buying a Phase, a digital medium format system.
Yeah.
And I think I remember him saying that exactly what we've just sort of talked about, which is it doesn't necessarily give him way better imagery, but he knows that if he brings it out to a client shoot, most people aren't shooting with those cameras, and he gets an interest that's piqued from the client saying, "Oh, what is that?" Right? By the look of it, the sound of it. And he says that that brings a perception of professionalism and something above the norm.
And value. I can attest to this happening to me as well, because I brought a Blackmagic camera, and even though the Blackmagic camera, cinema camera, it's a, you know, kind of a big beefy looking camera, very unusual styling, I brought that to a shoot, and even though it was not as good as what I currently have, it looked more impressive. Therefore, I had more value.
Yeah, we shouldn't forget about this thing of perception. I remember as well, there's a funny story. There's a shot that Annie Leibovitz took very early on in her career. I think after she finished shooting for Rolling Stone, and she set an umbrella up that ended up reflecting in the window of where she'd shot. And I remember she was being interviewed in a documentary, and she was like, "I actually didn't know what I was doing. I totally didn't realize that there was going to be a reflection of this strobe of the umbrella." And what she said was that people were coming back saying, "Oh my God, look at her vision. She's got this cool reflection. She's got all of this stuff." And I think what it led to her doing was actually setting up more lights than she even needed on a set. And there is this perception that a photographer that walks into a set with like one light only knows one light, versus if you walk into a set where there's six lights and a lot of them aren't doing anything, it's still a much more impressive set to a client who doesn't really know. And I can certainly attest to that. I've been on sets where I'm looking at lights thinking, "What is that doing there? It's not really doing anything." But it looks impressive. So I kind of get why they're doing it. So we shouldn't forget about the part that gear plays in terms of the perception to clients. But certainly I think as we all sort of mature through the process and we get, you know, the full frame cameras or the medium format cameras or the cameras that can shoot 4, 5, or 6K, it's sort of like, this isn't really allowing me to create much better stuff. It looks better, the production value is higher, but am I fundamentally creating better stuff?
Yeah, I guess what you're pointing out right here is where your focus is. Is your focus on impressing and getting more money out of jobs, or looking like you actually are worth what you're charging, or are you looking to produce something to yourself that is more fulfilling and a better piece of work that you like?
Mm.
And I think that's the line that is weird, because it's not the same.
Mm.
I might choose to shoot something for myself that I would be different than what I would choose to shoot for clients.
Definitely. Yeah.
So that's the line here. But I think Karaminder, you're right. The people who tend to talk about that gear doesn't matter are the ones that have the most gear, because they've had the experience of knowing that it doesn't matter. They have the experience of understanding where they came from and how much or how little adjusting their gear did for them. And that second thing that I said, which was the part where I'm trying to impress myself and do something for me, I might now know that what I could have shot on, which is why I shoot with my iPhone when I'm out and not with any other camera for the most part, is because I know that what I'm going to get out of any other camera is so marginally different than what I'm going to get out of my iPhone, that I don't really care enough to whip a different camera out, especially when my expectations of my image are at a certain level. So there you go. And that, I guess, kind of goes along with that point number five about gear is the reputation. So the whatever gear we choose to show, whatever gear Annie chooses to show, whether or not she's even using it, reputation is everything, especially for our brands.
Yeah.
Yes, agreed. Thank you, guys. Thank you, Dave, for being on the podcast this week.
You're welcome.
And Jaren.
Pleasure.
Thank you for coming us. Thank you for coming to us live from your parents' house in Salinas.
I'll let you know if I'll be here next week. I don't know. I'm going to be in Seattle next week, so we'll see. We'll try and juggle something together, but I might be.
Are we allowed to talk about why you're going to be in Seattle?
Yes, I will be part of a Creative Live thing. So I'm doing a Creative Live bus tour with Sue Bryce, Jasmine Starr, Matt Kloskowski.
Yeah, he's my boy. I love that guy.
Victor Ha. We're all getting on a bus and we're going from San Francisco all the way up to Seattle. And then that's Photo Week. And then I'm going to be on a media panel at Photo Week as well. So I'll be hanging out in Seattle from the 18th through like the 22nd.
That's all right. Awesome. And yeah, thank you guys for joining us. Comments, questions, you can reach us on Twitter at Rewrap Podcast. Dave, what's your Twitter?
At Dave Geffen, same as my Instagram, same as my Facebook.
That's good. That's consistency. That's
consistency,
brilliant.
Building the brand.
Yes. Jaren is at Jaren Schneider. I'm at Karaminder. Please rate us on iTunes, subscribe, and send us some Twitter love, and tell your friends to give us a listen. We'd really appreciate that. And this has been Rewrap Podcast, episode 30. My name is Karaminder. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye. Say bye, guys.
Bye.